I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Our Vayikra series, Kedusha is in the Details, explores the way the laws in this book try and elevate each of our most basic human functions, food intake, bodily functions, relationships, spaces of worship, and time. This year, I will be taking a particularly honest and candid look at the ways these laws do or do not yet function in our lives. This week's episode has been sponsored in honor of the Yahrzeit of Yaakov and Avraham Vemini, which will take place on Kaf Gimel Adar Bet. I remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Please write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website, or you can contact the office directly. Parshat Shmini opens with the completion of the Kohanim's inauguration, which comes to a traumatic culmination with the death of Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu. Immediately after their deaths, the Kohanim are warned about several laws, some in regard to the immediate prohibition to mourn for their deaths and other broader prohibitions like no drinking on the job. All of these stipulations have been mined throughout the centuries as possible sources of Nadav and Avihu's sin. Last year's episode on this Parsha, episode 103, with Chana Lakshenbab, went deep into the laws of Kashrut in their unique role amidst Vayikra's long unit on impurities, wherein the laws of Kashrut border two categories, the prohibition because of Kashrut and the prohibition because of the impurity that the non-kosher animals carry. We have lost a dimension of impurity and really today only focus on their prohibition of consumption. We also discussed the role of Kashrut in post-biblical and modern life and how they function and continue to function as a defining feature of religious life. Today's conversation will also address Kashrut, but from a completely different angle. Our guest today, Dr. Ari Greenspan, is the co-founder of the Petil Techelet Association. He is a practicing mohel, shochet, and sofer, and has worked for more than 30 years on collecting Jewish traditions and mesoret from far-flung Jewish communities around the globe. He pioneered the exotic kosher dinner as a means of passing along disappearing kosher food traditions. Dr. Greenspan has been producing commercial Judaica art for 25 years, enjoying wood, metal, and glass as his media. Oh, and by the way, he's also a practicing dentist. Dr. Ari Greenspan, it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So before we get into some of the details that you're going to bring about the world of Kashrut that I'm sure many of us are totally unfamiliar with, I guess, you know, from the little bit of your bio that I know and your deep interest in Tchelet and of, you know, sort of exotic Kashrut and, of course, the fact that as a base profession, you're a dentist. So you're a man with many interests and particularly within the Torah world, these are kind of like niche Torah interests. So I'm a little bit curious. I'm sure each element has its own story of evolution, but I guess I'm curious where this comes from, where these interests come from specifically.
So I grew up in the American Army. My father was a chaplain in the American Army. So I grew up as a rabbi's son in these very remote locations, sometimes in very, you know, really distant or places where in the 1960s and 70s, there were no Jewish communities. Certainly kosher food wasn't what it is today, where you can go into any supermarket and find an OU and pretty much anything, you know, you want. I decided at some point that I wanted to be a community rabbi. That didn't end up happening, but I've been traveling the Jewish world together with my partner, Dr. Ari Zivotofsky, and we've been to many tens of exotic Jewish communities in many continents around the world. And we sort of coined this term called halachic adventuring. And to be a halachic adventurer, you have to have certain halachic skills. And those skills started, among those skills were learning to be a shochet. And I did that when I was 18, when I was in Gush in the 80s. And in those days, you know, today it's like everybody can learn to be a shochet and everybody can learn to be a sofer and whatever you want to do. In those days, nobody did, you know, certainly not if you spoke the English language, that's for sure. We were 18 years old and we decided we wanted to learn Shechita. We knew nothing about Shechita. We knew nothing about Kashrut more than, you know, the average Jew. And it all started around a chicken that was bought to be slaughtered for Kaparot. You know, Erev Yom Kippur, there's a custom where you slaughter a chicken and you symbolically sort of place your sins on that chicken. And the whole yeshiva showed up to watch this little poor chicken being slaughtered, and it was slaughtered by a fellow who lives now in the Gush also, Nisim Mizrahi. And after that chicken was slaughtered, everybody promptly turned around and left, except for three of us. Me, Ari Zivotofsky, and Rabbi Yehuda Sussman. Rabbi Yehuda Sussman quickly turned around and left. And we were there while the shochet began to turn, take the chicken apart and pluck it and do whatever he did. And he looked up to us and he says, "Why don't you guys learn Shechita?" You know, like in my mind, you know, what good Jewish boy learned Shechita? Nobody. But the two of us decided that's what we wanted to do. Again, we did it purely out of the sense of halachic experience. We wanted to understand what it was about. And we found a Shechita teacher in Yerushalayim. He then was the head shochet in Yerushalayim. We learned to do birds. We learned to do sheep and cows. And that's sort of what started my interest in this issue. And the story behind the focus of this evening, which is going to be Mesorat and Kashrut, the Jewish tradition and the tradition needs in order to slaughter particularly some exotic kosher birds, started that year. Somebody in the States had asked me, once they knew I was a shochet, if I could slaughter a pheasant. Well, you know, I didn't know what a pheasant was. We're talking about a pre-internet era. It's like crazy to think about. You know, and you're in yeshiva. It's not like there was an encyclopedia that you could go look up what a pheasant is. There was no dictionary. And even if there was a dictionary, it would tell you that it's from the genus, you know, Physanidae or something like that, and it wouldn't have helped you. Anyway, we're talking about pheasant. The Hebrew word is fasion in the Beit HaMidrash and Gush. And as we'll discuss in a minute, there's a need for a tradition to slaughter kosher birds, because the Torah doesn't really give any signs of what is the definition of a kosher bird. For example, fish, we know, have to have fins and scales, right? Animals have to chew their cud and have split hooves. But the Torah just lists 24 types of birds that are not kosher, and the assumption is, and the Talmud sort of backs it up by saying pretty much everything else is kosher. So in theory, if you could identify the items that were not kosher, then in theory, everything else is kosher. We'll discuss the details in a minute. Anyway, we didn't know any of this because that's in Simon Pei Beit, you know, which is chapter 82 of Yoredeya, and Hilchot Shechita ends at 60, you know, so like we hadn't gotten there yet. And when you get to the laws of birds and you find out all these details, you understand you can't just take a bird. How do you know if it's a kosher bird? Anyway, the Talmud mentions the pheasant numerous times as a kosher bird. But the real question is, and this is the reason why you need the tradition, is how do you know that what they call the pheasant is what we call a pheasant? Anyway, we're discussing this in the Beit Midrash. There had been an article, sort of like the seminal article on pheasant and kashrut, was written by a man by the name of Professor Yehuda Felix. He was one of these early classic, you know, scholars on the Bible and did a lot of, you know, the basic.
Yeah, if anybody's ever used the Dat Nikras series, then they've utilized a lot of his research. He wrote on the botany of Shir HaShirim, and you know, he really was,
right.
Yeah, the big wig in early Israel, early state of Israel. Yeah,
correct. So as a result of the story I'm about to tell you, so Ari Zivotofsky and I became actually very good friends with him. And we stayed in touch with him for many, many decades, actually. Anyway, we're discussing this article that Felix had written on this topic. And Felix pretty much traced the halachic references to the pheasant through the Talmudic period and the post-Talmudic period and through the Rishonim and even into, you know, to the, let's say, the late 1800s, the last few times the pheasant had been mentioned halachically. And then sometime around the year, late 1800s or so, was the last halachic reference to the pheasant that could be traced. Anyway, we're sitting in the Beit Midrash, but we're standing there in the back by the stairs, if you know what I'm talking about. And we mentioned the word fasion, which is the Hebrew name, and walks by a Yemenite, Hanan el-Seri, who was in the Beit Midrash. And Hananel heard the word pheasant, and he says, "You guys discussing the bird?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "You know, Rav Kapach was the head of the Yemenite the Yemenite Jews of Israel. He was one of the great, great scholars on the Rambam in his day. He did all the original work on the Rambam and translated from the Arabic parts of the Rambam, and it was on the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. One of the very, very great Yemenite rabbinic scholarly families for generations. Anyway, Rav Kapach evidently that week or the week before had given a class and said, he mentioned the pheasant and he mentioned eating the pheasant in Yemen. He remembered it. So here we were sort of like energized because Felix had written about it. Felix sort of ended at some point with the pheasant, meaning he couldn't go any further. And somehow by serendipity, Hanana walks by. We didn't know who he was. We had never talked to him before. And he heard the word pheasant and he said, Rav Kapach mentioned it. So Ari and I went to meet Professor Felix and we're talking about it. And Felix is explaining to us how when he was doing his research, he had a stuffed pheasant, you know, like a taxidermied pheasant. And he would walk into these old rabbis around the country, rabbis from North Africa, rabbis from Yemen, rabbis from wherever, from Europe, and he would walk in with this stuffed bird and see if they recognize the bird. Because if you need a tradition, if you need a masoret, it has to be a tradition that somebody recognizes the bird. Anyway, he wasn't able to find anybody that recognized the bird. But we then went to visit Rav Kapach. I'll never forget, Rav Kapach was sitting in the basement of his house. He lived in a two-story house. And he was sitting there cross-legged on a bench. I'd never seen a rabbi sit cross-legged without shoes before. He was a Yemenite scholar. He was poring over these tomes of ancient books. I wouldn't be surprised if they were handwritten copies of the Rambam. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. I mean, he actually did work on the actual script of the Rambam. So who knows if there was a real Rambam there. And Ari and I went to see him and we started talking to him about Masoret. And he was so excited to see two young guys who were interested in the reality of halacha. I remember he jumped up. His room was completely packed with papers and books. And he sort of went down on the ground behind his desk and he came up with an ibex horn. And he was like proudly showing us that he slaughtered this ibex, okay? Anyway, he told us, yes, I know what the pheasant is and I can recognize the pheasant and so on. So we decided, okay, let's go get a pheasant. Now, there's one pre-skip to the story that I didn't start with. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked in the 1960s, what about pheasant? And Rav Moshe Feinstein tried to find shoftim from Europe alive that recognized the pheasant and he couldn't find anybody. And Rav Moshe Feinstein basically said, we've lost the tradition on the pheasant, therefore the pheasant can't be eaten unless you could find a great rabbi or a completely reliable, you know, witness who could say that, yes, he had a tradition. Okay, that's where we stood. So we decided we would get a pheasant. How do you find a pheasant in Israel in a pre-internet era? Okay, so I went to the biblical zoo. They said, yes, we have pheasants. We said, could we buy one? They said, yes, we'll sell you one. What do you want it for? We said, well, we want to shecht it. Well, they kicked us out of the biblical zoo, okay? We were told there's a bird man. What's a bird man? Someplace, there were no cars, there was no ways, there was nothing, you know? There was someplace in Tel Aviv, I didn't even know the difference between Tel Aviv and Bnei Brak. You know, it was all Tel Aviv to me. Somebody over there was called the bird man. He had a Holocaust story, lost his family, and in memory of the Holocaust, he had this big bird collection. We went to visit him. He said, no, I don't have any pheasants. He says, but up north, and he gave us the name of some kibbutz. There's no phone directories. There's no way to reach anybody. We got on a bus going north. We were two stupid Americans. We had no idea about anything going on in Israel. We didn't understand the politics of Israel. We didn't understand the left and the right. And as we're driving north of Haifa, we begin to realize that there are no cars on the road. There are only military cars on the road and tanks and trucks. It was 3 days before the initial Lebanon war, the first Lebanon war. So we arrive at this kibbutz and we get on the bus. We've got these two live pheasants in a bag or something. And we bring them down, and the next day we go to Professor Felix, who was jumping out of his skin with excitement, because you know what it's like. Here he is, this scholar and academic that wrote an article that no one else had ever written about before, and he hadn't touched it in years, and these two young guys show up with live birds to slaughter. More than that, we're taking him to meet Rav Kapach. So we went to Rav Kapach's house, and my buddy Ari had a camera, you know. For those of you on this call that don't understand what a camera meant in those days, it meant that there's something called film in the camera. And you had either 24 pictures or 36 pictures. So every picture you took was valuable mm-hmm. because you never knew whether you would have another picture left, right? Anyway, so Ari took a picture of Rav Kapach shechting one bird. And he took this beautiful picture of me as an 18-year-old with Rav Kapach behind me, sort of like the umpire behind the catcher, behind, you know, home plate, looking at me. And you see me holding this bird and you see Ari and you see Rav Kapach standing behind me. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And Rav Kapach watched, and I shechted the bird. And then Rav Kapach took us inside, and he wrote us a document that for me was a seminal document in our lives, because he referred to us as rabbis, which already, you know, we were 18 years old, so that was nice, you know. Yeah. But he said, and the text was really quite astounding. I don't have it in front of you, but the text says, so-and-so, Ari Greenspan, Ari Tsitsipas, came before me with a bird that's called fasion in Hebrew. In Arabic, it's called darj. In Yemenite, it's called tadarj. I know that it's a kosher bird and that it has a mesoret. I saw great rabbis before me slaughter and eat this bird. Okay? And all of a sudden, he hands us this piece of paper with his signature and his stamp from the Rabbanut HaRashit. And, you know, all of a sudden we're saying to ourselves, wait a minute, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Posek Hador for the Ashkenazic world, doesn't have a tradition on this bird. He wrote a tshuva that he doesn't have a tradition on the bird. But Ari Zivotofsky, whoops.
So I just am very interested in biographies. I want to just go back to a point you mentioned right at the beginning of what you said, which was about this idea of that you traveled, right? You were in the military. You kind of were used to being a Jew, you know, in the rogue and not having all of like the classic amenities available to you. And I think that that's just a really interesting point, because from what you're describing, and we've obviously only heard a tiny, tiny portion of a much longer story, that kind of, it creates a flexibility of religious life. Like for people who are growing up in a very comfortable religious setting, and I would even say, blessedly, in the state of Israel, right? In the state of Israel, kashrut is not something that anybody has trouble with. Meaning, if you want to keep kosher, this is not a challenging situation. You know, I did not grow up in the military, but many decades ago, I could say at this point, I grew up in a very small town that had a very limited amount of kosher meat. There were no kosher restaurants, which sounds like utterly crazy to many people who are growing up in sort of much more centralized, you know, with these central big locations where Jews live. And kal vachomer if you're traveling around and you're in the army. So I just want to just point out this basic fact, which is that it also created like a flexibility. Also, an interest in all of this is because you're a unique personality, but it also creates this ability to say, this is something I'm going to work hard for. Like, this is something that interests me and is important for me enough that I'm going to put in that effort to go and sort of seek that out. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I know what you mean. I think that everybody has the opportunity and the ability to choose anything that they want to and put that effort into if it's something that interests them. The thing is that for most religious people, especially today, you grow up in a cocoon, you know, and that cocoon is very comfortable and very warm, but it rarely exposes you to, let's call it the opportunities of inflection, you know, that give you that ability to be Jewish in ways that nobody does. I'll give you two examples. About a month ago, I returned from the far east in India, where together with another rabbi, we gave a get, a religious divorce document to a Jewish woman who's in jail there. Now, you know, you can't even begin to imagine the traveling and the what was involved and getting to the jail, but then performing the halachic process and the text and the physical things that needed to be done in order to give a get. Or an amazing example is my close buddy Yehuda Kalani, who lives in Tanzania, in Africa. Yehuda grew up as a secret Jew in a Muslim country that was very, very anti-Israel. He grew up in his father and grandfather's lap, completely religious and knowledgeable. And my buddy Ari Zivotofsky and I went to visit him when we heard about this guy. We actually were in Kenya slaughtering for the Jewish community, shechting kosher meat and birds for them once. And we said, let's go someplace interesting for Shabbos. are there any interesting Jewish communities around? I went online and we found this place called Tanzania with a supposed Jewish community. He looks black, Yehuda. He's a Yemenite Jew. And anyway, make a long story short, we became very close. And last Pesach, I went to be with him for his Seder with my wife. And I slaughtered some birds and some sheep for the Seder for him. And he just mentions, it came out. He says, wow, this is the first time in 13 years that we're going to have the Zeruah on our Seder tray. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, my father, who was our Shochet, died 13 years ago, so we haven't had a Zeruah on the Seder tray. And it just blew me away for a minute because, of course, we use like a chicken bone or something. And because it's been sitting there, because we cooked it the day before Pesach, and it's been sitting there overnight, and probably sometimes in the middle of Chol Moed, we throw it away because nobody wants to eat it. We don't think twice about what's involved, and then the energy that a Jew needs to invest to make his Seder meaningful to them. For us, it's not meaningful to take a chicken leg out of a thing, but for Yehuda, it was damn meaningful. So I said to him, well, what did you do for 13 years? He said, we would take a leek, because a leek looks like a bone, and we would burn it, and we would put it on our Seder tray.
Wow.
So those are two examples of the richness of Jewish life that with the wonderfulness of living in the state of Israel or in these, very cocoon-like Jewish communities, that richness has been forgotten and has disappeared to a certain extent.
Yeah,
and only by putting yourself into uncomfortable positions, and sometimes putting yourself out there, can you experience that greatness and the excitement of that Judaism.
But I think that I'm just going to point to two other things, meaning what you need to be able to do that is a degree of knowledge, meaning because for some people, they just walk out of a place, they walk to a place with no Erev, and they will have no idea what to do because they've never, meaning on one hand, halachic Judaism, in a certain regard, can make people feel a little bit stuck, meaning I can't do X because of halacha. But you're presenting a totally different internal position, which is that halacha, I'd like to say in Hebrew, halacha olechet iti, it walks with me, and I can, I have all of those capabilities, and I can go to all these far-flung places being who I am with that confidence, and that swag, but also... But it's because there's a certain knowledge. But what your point?
Yeah, please.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, of course, you have to have knowledge. And if you don't have knowledge, you can't do anything in this world, right? But people are a little bit afraid of that knowledge and think that you need a rabbi. Oh, I'm not a rabbi. How could I? But what are you talking about? Your great grandfather traveling through Europe as a salesman or as a whatever. He had to learn how to keep kosher. He had to learn, You have to be willing to do it. Or as my friend says beautifully, you have to have a little bit of Hebrew here, but he says, nobody, anashim lo ochlim kosher, nobody eats kosher anymore. They eat kashriyot.
Yeah.
It's a play on words with kosher. They eat hashkachot. I eat OU. I eat rabbanut. But nobody knows what does that mean to have kosher, how to kosher a piece of meat. What happens if you're in India and you come to an Indian oven and you see them making bread on the side of the oven? Are you allowed to eat that bread? Well, if you know halacha, it's a black and white question. Why should you ever have to starve any place in the world?
Yeah.
It's never a problem if you know the halacha. But okay,
I just want to say a really funny story that you made me think of is that my husband has this great story. He was walking once through Mea Shearim, and there was this guy, a Yemenite shochet, it was also close to Chag, and he was like shechting chickens on the street. And he saw two yeshiva bacharim, who also were Anglo, come up to the guy and says, what's your hashkacha? And he goes, Kurim li Tzvanya, ze hashkacha Tzvanya. And they totally didn't get it. And they were like, no, it's machbut, what? And they're like, I'm the shochet. If you trust me, then it's kosher. But my husband's laughing. He's like, they didn't even realize what does hashkacha mean? Meaning, this is a man who knows he learned how to be a shochet, the food is kosher. I want to just go back to this point about Masora. I want you to clarify for our listeners, if you read, there's two basic prakim in the Torah that detail kosher and unkosher, tameh and tahor animals, which are two different dimensions of kashrut. I'll just say this just to sort of level the playing field, that the world of kashrut is actually one of these fascinating points in the book of Vayikra, where it both touches upon the world of what is prohibited and allowed, and also what is considered to be pure and impure. It has two different kinds of elements to it. Of course, the element of Tuman Tahara has fallen away in the world, like all other elements of Tuman Tahara that we don't really keep today. But of course, the side of prohibited and permitted animals and all different creatures that we're allowed to eat is still prominent in our lives. But if you read those two prakim, one of which doesn't even have the list of animals that we can eat. It only lists what we can't eat, which is in our parak in Vayikra. You're not left with all that much, meaning it's one of these places where you clearly need Torah Shebaal Peh. We could really never go forward with that because there are no details about what it means to take the animal from its living state and make it something that we're allowed to actually put in our bodies. So I'm curious if you could just explain to us a little bit about this concept of Mesorah, about how we go from having an animal that's it's permissible to eat, which of course you have much to say about animals that are permissible, but we didn't have a clear continuing Mesorah, but there were Mesorot all over the world that we then had to go and discover them. But just to explain that concept of what that means really.
Okay, so let's take a step back first of all. We throw around the words kosher and not kosher. That's not really a word that it doesn't appear in the Bible. It doesn't really appear in the Talmud. We talk about two types of animals. Let's not talk about animals or birds or anything like that. We talk about animals and birds that are either permitted, or let's use the word kosher. But if they're not kosher, what that means is there's something called a trefa and there's something called a nevela, okay? There's a rabbinic or a Torah Shebaal Peh, that there are 18 types of, let's call them anatomical deficiencies or different diseases that the Torah Shebaal Peh describes inside the body of an animal that would make the animal a trefa. For example, a hole in certain organs, a hole in the lung or whatever the different things are. That's called a trefa. That word has really become the catch-all. People, oh, it's a trefa, we can't eat it, you know. But not as everything a trefa. There's also a term called a nevela. Nevela means that it might be an animal that's not a trefa, meaning the animal is anatomically considered to be okay, and theoretically you could eat it if it was slaughtered properly. But if it's improperly slaughtered, again, a host of laws and a host of oral, Torah Shebaal Peh in that respect, it's called a nevela. So first of all, we have animals that are permitted to be eaten, but they can be invalidated either by anatomic, physical disease states or by improperly being slaughtered, okay? So let's now refer to what is potentially, we're going to use the word kosher, but I don't mean kosher, I mean something that has the potential to be eaten. It's unlimited. Pretty much any four-legged animal, okay, or the vast majority of four-legged animals that we would find wild animals that are in the bovine family are kosher. If you were to go to the on a safari in Africa, you would see zillions more animals that if you were to catch them and slaughter them with a kosher knife, they would be kosher animals. All of the buffalo, all of the gazelles, all of those families of deer and all of those animals are kosher. So actually, you know, if you look around the barnyard, you're more than likely to find kosher animals than you are to find non-kosher animals in that respect. So you can go any place in the world and you can find kosher animals. In Papua New Guinea, in the jungle, in the highlands, with a tribe that claims to be Jewish, one of them told me when we were kids, it was really fun why we would go hunting. I said, what'd you hunt for? Oh, we'd go for alligator or crocodile, whatever. And he says, and we would also go for deer. So I said, you can catch deer? You could kill deer in the jungle? He says, yeah. I said, could you catch a live one? I said, of course. So they went and caught a live deer. And I had my shlita knife with me because if you don't take it to Papua New Guinea, where do you take it, right? And we slaughtered this animal. And they made a grill. What do you make a grill out of? Fresh bamboo. And we roasted the animal. And in the middle of the jungle, you had a real feast. Anyway, let's just get back to the topic of tradition. So there is no such thing as tradition on animals that have the signs that the Torah mentions. So the Torah says animals that are quadrupeds, four legs, if they have split hooves and chew their cuds, they're kosher. So there's no need for a tradition on that to say that an animal is a kosher animal. Now, there are two types of animals in that respect. You have a wild creature. The Torah refers to it as a chaya, okay? And then you have a domesticated animal, which is a behemoth, like a cow or something like that. A chaya would be a deer, let's say. And the only difference there would be that certain fats are prohibited in a behemoth, an animal. Those were the animals, let's say, that were brought on the altar in the temple, and those were the chelev, the fats that were sort of, you know, burnt and sent up to heaven. But on the wild animals, the deer and those sorts of things, those animals, that chelev is permitted to eat. So there might be a question on how do you define what a chaya is versus an animal. Then do you need a masorah? Maybe yes, maybe no. Leave that for now. But if I see an animal with four legs and it has split hooves and chews its cud, I can slaughter it. And as long as I don't eat the chela, the forbidden fats, I'm allowed to eat it. However, with birds, that's not the case. And there's a story in the Talmud of some sort of a waterfowl. It was called the Tarnagola de Agma, which means it's a waterfowl. And there was another bird by the name of Tarnagolta de Adma, similar, some sort of a waterfowl. One was a kosher bird, one was a bird that was able to be eaten, and one wasn't. There was some sort of a mistake made once, and as a result, already there's a halacha that's brought that one should have a tradition, a masoret, on which bird to eat. Okay, we'll discuss what that means in a second. And already the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch, in the 1500s, I think that is, says that you can only eat birds that have a tradition, and that became what the halacha is. The Mishnah, struggling with this issue, understanding that there were no physical signs on birds that are mentioned in the Torah, like there are with animals, right? There's no hooves, there's no chew their cuds. So the Mishnah says, gives us four physical signs. And evidently in the time of the Mishnah, through the time of the Gemara, you could find a bird, and if the four signs applied, you could slaughter that bird and eat that bird. And it was only later that this issue, this concern of a mistake crept in and became what we today call the halacha. The Rambam, for example, doesn't say that you need a tradition on birds. Rambam goes with the Mishnah that says that if an animal is a dores, an attacking bird, like an eagle, so you see, it attacks out of the sky, it eats live prey, live meat, you know, it grabs it with its talons. So that is, if that's the case, it's not kosher. But if that's not the case, then you look for three signs. The signs are, it has something called a crop. A crop is the first stop in the digestive tract. It's under the skin, sort of in the neck or the top of the neck, side of the neck and the top of the breast of the animal. And animals that don't eat meat, that eat grains, let's say birds that don't eat meat or that eat grains. So there can be some rocks in there, and sometimes it gets a little bit ground there, and the enzymes probably start to break it down. And when you feed a chicken its grain or its corn, you see that that little thing gets a little fat there. The last stop on the digestive tract is something called the kurkuvan. We call it the gizzard in English. The gizzard has a membrane on the inside of it, and inside this gizzard, it's like the size of, depends on the size of the bird, but let's say half the size of a fist, let's say, and it's the last stop of the digestive tract, and it actually has rocks in it. It collects rocks that the bird ate, and it's a very strong muscle, and it grinds everything, the last bit of the food. And when you cut it open, there's a membrane, and the Mishnah and the rabbis, really being great observers of anatomy and science, knew, because they were empirically interested, I guess, in nature, that on animals that we would call kosher birds, tahor birds, the membrane easily peels off the meat of the gizzard, as opposed to animals that don't eat grains but eat meat. That membrane doesn't peel off. And Ari and I, my buddy, we've done research on this. We once went to a slaughterhouse for ostriches, for example. And the first thing we wanted to see was, does this membrane peel on an ostrich, which isn't a kosher bird? And the final sign is that the language of Chazal is there's an etzba yetera. It sounds like there's an extra finger on the bird. And the different understandings, what it is, doesn't really matter, but There are anatomical things. Make a long story short, at some point in Jewish history, most Jews gave up on this issue of these signs and relied upon or were accepted the halacha that we need a tradition. What does a tradition mean? A tradition means generally a visual and an oral tradition that you go to somebody, you say, here, I've got this bird. Are you familiar with the bird? And the truth is that throughout Jewish history, you know, every shochet knew the birds in his neighborhood. If you were from Germany, so you knew what birds your great-grandmother ate because the shochtim shechted those birds, and the birds were all caught wild, except for, chickens and ducks, which they grew or whatever. But I'm talking about the more exotic wild birds, and the rabbis in Yemen knew their birds, and the rabbis in North Africa knew their birds. In fact, I have here in front of me a fascinating book printed in, I think, 1832 in Livorno, Italy. It's a book on shchita and trefot and things like this. And this rabbi did what other rabbis had done, but never graphically. He actually made a poster that came with the book of 30 birds, pictures, drawings of each bird with its Latin name. And this was the tradition of the community of Livorno, that these 30 birds, including the pheasant, by the way, were kosher birds. I think it was the Kaf HaChaim. I think it was the Kaf HaChaim. He says, "V'ra'iti et ha'masorah shel Livorno." In other words, I saw the masorah of the city of Livorno in Italy. Meaning what? He got the Zivchei Kohen. He saw the poster that came with the book. And he says, okay. So, but what happened was about 70 or 80 years ago, especially with the beginning of the State of Israel, but also with the advent of commercial slaughter, most Jewish communities, slaughterhouses began to disappear. It became centralized and they became factory slaughter. And 70, 80, maybe 90 years ago already, in the 1920s already, maybe it was starting. And it became a professional business. You no longer had your town shochet who you would bring your birds to. Very few places left in the world where that exists. The island of Djerba off the coast of Tunisia still has that. People still bring their birds to the shochet every Friday morning so they can have their birds for Shabbos, But a crazy thing happened. So it became localized into the hands of a few experts, these shoftim. And what birds do you slaughter in a slaughterhouse? The only birds that are economically feasible to, A, run through the machinery, and B, make it worth everyone's while to make money. What are those? Chicken, turkey, maybe duck. Occasionally geese, maybe, So you have 70 years, 80 years, 90 years of shoftim who have never seen anything other than four or five birds. And these traditions began to disappear and almost completely disappeared. And as a result of this story with Rav Moshe Feinstein and Ari Zivotofsky and myself, we became interested. Now, if you remember, we received the tradition from Rav Kapach. We got this letter. And we said, hey, let's write Rav Moshe Feinstein and ask him. He said the pheasant is not permitted because he couldn't find a rabbi with a masoret. So let's write him and tell him. So we wrote, again, this is before the internet, right? This was probably even before faxes. We wrote a letter in 1981 to Rav Moshe Feinstein saying that, we saw this bird. We brought the bird before Rav Kapach. Here's Rav Kapach's testimony. Here's the letter that he saw the bird, that he gave us the bird, and so on. Anyway, we received maybe a year later, 9 months later, we received an answer saying, no, from his Rav Moshe's secretary, saying, you misunderstood Rav Moshe, you need both a visual and an oral masorah. And we wrote back, we said, what are you talking about? I'm going to read our letter. We have a visual and an oral masorah. And by the time he got that letter, Rav Moshe was too sick and Rav Moshe passed away.
Wow.
But this spurred Ari Zivotofsky and I on. And Rev Tendler's son-in-law was Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, who was a professor of biology in Yeshiva University, well-known posek rabbi, unusual character. And I was very friendly with him, and he actually, his daughter lives on my street here, and every summer he would come. In fact, the later years of his life, we had a chavruta when he would come in the summer, and I would learn with him. Anyway, I was telling him about this story. Actually, it was I took him to the Tchelet factory in the early years of the Tchelet factory. And I was just in the car schmoozing and I'm telling him this story. And he couldn't believe that Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked by me about this question. He says, when I came to Israel in the 60s and Rav Moshe was researching this tshuva, he asked me to see if I could find the masoret on the pheasant in Israel, and I couldn't find it. I really don't know why, but I happened to have my Shulchan Aruch Yoredeh in the back seat of the car. And I said, hold on. I pulled over and I found the letter from Moshe Feinstein. And he saw that the secretary that sort of blew us off was his son. And he was really annoyed at his son. So I jokingly said to him, you know what, when you come back next summer, I'll find some pheasant and we'll slaughter pheasant. And that was the impetus for the Masorah project that my buddy Ari and I started. And what was the Masorah project? We understood that we were on the cusp of a historical era where all of these old shochtim from Yemen and North Africa and Europe and Asia and wherever were about to die. And we, you know, it's rare that you can see history while it's happening. And we understood that we have maybe a decade where we could reach out and touch these old Jewish worlds that were gone. And I said to Ari, I said, you know what? When Tendler comes back next summer, let's make a Suda and we'll pass on these traditions. And we started that year and then for many years, traveling around Israel wherever we could find old shochtim and old rabbis that claimed to have Masorah on different birds. And we even taxidermied some birds so we could walk around to them. And I remember we were looking for a masoret on the partridge. You know, partridge is a chogla, it's mentioned in halacha and so on, but again, it's the partridge that we call a partridge. Is that what the tradition is on a partridge? And there was this one rabbi, he was from Kurdistan. And I'll just never forget it. It was amazing. We have a stuffed partridge and we walked into the room and I was holding this bird in front of me. He didn't know we were coming. He was an old man. He was in a wheelchair. And as I came into the room, he saw me holding this bird and like it was like the language of a guild. You know, it's like a like not a secret language, but a language that if, you know, you, whatever field you're in, you know, you meet a compatriot in your field, you can start talking. And there's a certain, you know, certain words you would use that, you know, like professional language, right? Anyway, he sees the bird before he says, who are you? What are you doing here? And he says, Ze of Tahor, yesh lanu mesoret avotenu biyadenu. This is a kosher bird and I have the tradition of my forefathers in my hands. And then he went on to tell us the name of the bird in Kurdish and in Turkish. And anyway, we started documenting all of this. We started videotaping it. We started getting written evidence. And ultimately, we had a Masorah. I don't even remember now on how many birds. And Rabbi Tendler came. And we started the first of numerous halachic meals, we call them, Sodot Halacha, where we had many, many small courses of different animals and birds and plants and grasshoppers and you know all of these different things where we passed on the Masorah in a public manner and subsequently this thing's been copied and other people have done it as well and you know and there's nobody left anymore from that world. We were very lucky that we saw the halachic imperative and that we acted in a time where there was still a window that we could do it.
You know,
and we touched that world. It was really very special in retrospect to think about that.
One of the, you know, the important word here of Masorah, I'm going to say something that's not coming from my halachic hat because I do function in that world, although I have to say halachic kashrut is not something that it's not one of the areas that I've specialized in, but I think there's also something very powerful about that word, specifically when it comes to food, because, you know, you're speaking about essentially, right, what people have been eating over the generations and the halachic tradition surrounding that. And so, because how you're describing it now, it feels very rogue, meaning it feels very, you know, okay, well, there's someone, they used to eat it, they said it was okay, and we're going to eat it. And it sounds much less regimented than how we envision. And I would even say, to a certain degree, how many other halachic realms do function, meaning a lot of those realms do function the way that we sort of imagine halachic life to be, or what the sources look like. There's something here that feels much, much freer. You know, again, you said there are specific signs, but to a certain degree that was given up because it was too complex to perhaps put into practice. And so on one hand, the Mesorah is a bit more of a machmir position because we're giving up on those signs, which probably could have even opened it up even more. But also, mm-hmm. there's something here that feels very, very fitting, because food is something that is very cultural, traditional, communal based. And as you said, it's become industrialized. It's become so far removed from where we function. I'll just throw in one little story of my own, nowhere as exotic as yours, but we order eggs. We order organic eggs for our home. And in the past 2 months or so, we've had a great winter here in Israel. They come every other week, and the woman who's, you know, it's her father's farm in Tzkoa, and she said, for now, everybody can only get one tray. Why? Because it's the winter and there's less sun, you know, sun hours, and we do not put the chickens in artificial light. So however many hours of light there is, that's how many eggs there are. And I remember she sent us that message, and I said, okay, on one hand, I'm going to be a little bit hungrier, but I'm so happy that I get to tell my children that. No, I'm being serious, meaning we've just come a little bit closer to nature, because yes, we're going to have a few less eggs because we are respecting the chickens and we're living in sync with nature. And right now, they're not going to be laying as many eggs. So of course, our life has become so far removed from all of those elements. And so there's just something that feels very organic to me about this word Mesorah that keeps coming up, which on one hand, luckily, is a bit mach, but on the other hand, feels very fitting. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense. It makes sense. I think that, again, you know, it's a little bit of a philosophy of life for me. Halacha is meant to be lived. Halacha is not meant to be read from a book. And, it's the same thing when, you know, whether it's tefillin, where you buy tefillin. What do you mean you buy tefillin? Why don't you write tefillin? And if you don't know how to write tefillin, why don't you at least know how tefillin are written, you know, or tchelet, you know, for 1300 years, we didn't have tchelet. So, I mean, it didn't dawn on me to go scuba diving for it till my buddy came to me and said, why don't you? And I went scuba diving and we found the tchelet snail after 1300 years. To a certain extent, I've been very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. But of course, it's a certain personality type, and you know, I'm sure that there'd be rabbis that would say, oh, you know, who are you to do this? But I think it's very authentic. I don't think that it's any different than, you know, the rabbis of the Talmud that were arguing over a particular word. I mean, the halacha is very clear. Eid echad ne'eman bisurim. Okay? An individual, a witness, is completely reliable when it comes to things that or relate to, let's say, kashrut or personal halachic issues. If you have an eid echad, a single witness, you don't need two witnesses, who says this bird was eaten, it is 100% acceptable. The same way if you have a woman who says that I'm no longer a nida, you know, and I'm able to go, you know, you don't need to go before two witnesses that check the woman out, of course not. That's the source of Eid Echad Ne'eman Bisurin. Mm-hmm. And it's just that we live in such a regimented and such a commercial world that halacha has been taken out of the hands of the individual and has been handed to the world of the rabbinic institutions, which has advantages too, but it has disadvantages as well.
Right. I guess if I would throw out one thing, I don't know where this will take you, but meaning one of the stated goals of even say the Pnei Halacha series, which again, one can say what they want to say about his halachic positions, but one of the stated goals is to put that back in the hands of people actually following halacha. Again, it's whether what it produces is a whole different story, but I think that that's a very powerful idea. I think also one other thing I want to say, which you didn't say specifically, but I know that you believe this, which is that what your endeavor is very far from some sort of like meat gorging fest, right? Meaning this is really a celebration of halacha tradition. Yeah. Meaning this is about keeping alive halachic traditions. Yes, it's surrounding food, but it's also surrounding tzitzit, right?
No, I thought no. The whole thing was A, to enjoy the food, you know. But in addition to that, it was to pass on traditions. And look, we had one meal. We had 18 courses, but each course was a 5-minute shiur, you know, or a 10-minute shiur with video and images and halakhic sources and a source book that was 250 pages for the meal. I wanted to tell you another beautiful aspect about this is the ability to interact with Talmidei Chachamim. So when we were also working on both the partridge and a bird called the guinea hen, we were in the car coming from the north, and somebody said there's this rabbi, Rav Machbud in Bnei Brak, who's this big shochet expert. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm not in that world of Kashruyot, you know, like I don't know the people, I don't know the Kashruyot, I don't know, you know, but he is the big name in that Haredi world today. So they drove us to his Beit Din. We came into his house. He lives in a very tsanua, simple sort of apartment in Bnei Brak. And I mean, he's a very important man today. He's on the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of Shas. He's, you know, one of the top guns there.
And he's also Yemenite?
Yeah, he's also Yemenite.
Yeah, interesting.
And this interaction that I'm about to tell you, you know, really allowed us from different worlds completely. I don't want to say become friends because he's one of the big gdolim in Israel today, but we have a very, you know, real relationship and a friendship around halacha that he doesn't have with the people he's with, because the people he's with, you know, will bow down and kiss his hand literally as he sees them, you know. We brought him these two birds, and we had a discussion about the birds, and we ended up, he ended up shechting a pheasant, I think, and so on. And he also found it very interesting because, again, he's a shochet. That's how we started. And he had certain traditions that he received, so he was a little tickled by the whole event because nothing like this had ever happened before. Two guys show up with these exotic birds. And we must have gone back to him another time or two with some questions, and then somehow we went to shecht with him. He went shechting someplace, I don't remember. And we asked him about matzah, because Ari and I have been baking matzah since we were 18 years old, 19 years old. And we've researched matzah and all the matzah traditions. And anyway, this basically led to this friendship whereby numerous times a year, we'll travel with him around to Israel, to his factories. And then, believe it or not, a man like this has great and wide interests. So we've taken him on many tiulim to halachic historical sites, to Talmudic synagogue sites, to Ir David. 2 weeks ago, we were with him in matzah factories and in a talis factory. And in 2 weeks, we're taking him to the Rabbanut army base. You know, so my point here is that, you know, a Selech HaRav sort of thing, you know, or Meshamesh Talmidei Chachamim, because just being around them enriches who you are and enriches your halachic knowledge base, you know, knowledge and experience. And I have to say, you know, it's really quite amazing to be able to call him up and hear his happiness at hearing my voice and, you know, say, would you like to go on a tiyul? Of course, we're not wasting anyone's time. We're going on a halachic tiyul. We're going on a wherever it is that we're going. But, you know, I think that's what Chazal talk about when, you know, say, you know, spend time around Talmidei Chachamim, because there's so much that you can learn. And I'm not talking in the art scroll sort of book sense where you watch how they wash their hands and how they, you know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a real relationship, and it's enriched me greatly, I have to say. So all of this comes from birds and Masorah.
We're going to be winding down our conversation, although I have a feeling we could probably have many parts of this conversation as we hear about your, I feel a Kashrut memoir coming on. But maybe a last interesting point that you have for us. Again, so much of what we do, we really know very little about the origins of how we got to that point, how we eat that thing. As we said, we're so far removed from it. So I'm curious if any other tidbit to share with us about that might be, I don't know, pretty directly relevant to how people are functioning in their lives.
I'll tell you, let's discuss the kashrut of turkey for a minute, okay? Mm-hmm. Turkey's a bird, that comes from the United States, right? It's a bird that they found when Columbus came to the United States, or maybe it wasn't Columbus that found the bird, but it was a bird from North America. And how is it possible for us to eat it? There's no way it could have had a Masoret on it, because there were no Jews in America mm-hmm. when America was discovered, right? And even how does it have the name India? Turkey, right? And in Yiddish, it's called Hindik, which means India.
Yeah.
And we know that it was quickly taken from North America into Europe. Shakespeare mentions a turkey. Somehow it got to Turkey, and maybe that's how, or people said it came from Turkey, from in India, America, the West Indies, they thought they had found the route to India, so the spice route, they were looking for the spice route. So when they first came to America, there were mistakes as to what it was. So maybe that's how it became called a Hindik in Yiddish, or I imagine if it was called that in Yiddish, it was in other languages as well. There were people who didn't eat the turkey because there was no Masoret on it. There's even a ketubah someplace that says, I'll marry you on the condition that you don't feed me turkey.
What?
Okay. And until today, a few families of great rabbis, European rabbis, at least the rabbis, the fathers of the family, don't eat the turkey because there's no tradition. But how is it that Israel, the United States of Israel, has the largest consumption per capita of turkey in the world, and Americans all over the world eat turkey, and the OU slaughters kosher turkey? And I think this is a beautiful example of halacha in practice, despite the fact that one needs a masoret to eat a bird. It became so prevalent in the Jewish world that probably by default, there was no way to stop Jews eating it. There's one tshuva, I don't remember now the name of the tshuva, I think, but I remember reading it, it was like they're trying to find reasons to say that you can eat the turkey, because obviously everybody's eating the turkey. And, and it says, well, we've raised them by the hundreds of thousands, and we've seen them for the tens of years, and we've never seen a single turkey attack another bird or another animal. It's not a dorez. It's mm-hmm. clearly a kosher bird, and it has all the signs of, obviously somebody had a masorah, on the turkey. But here we have a beautiful example of, doesn't matter what the halacha says, Am Yisrael were koveya what the practice is, and then the rabbis sometimes have to sort of find a way to back into it.
Everything you're describing is really the main reason why, after Tanakh learning, my passion is halachic learning. Right now with my chavruta, we're learning Hilchot Avelut. And my favorite part of halachic learning is not the reading comprehension part, but it's about seeing history. Meaning when we read the sources, we say, oh, that's interesting. That's how they expressed their mourning. Or that's what they assumed that kind of gesture meant. Like that to me is like those moments in halachic learning are for me what give me a total high. I literally can't start my week any other way. That's what I do every Sunday morning, my chavruta. And it sounds silly, like I'm learning Hilchot Avelut, like... but it's that, and any halacha you learn, and everything you're saying, if anybody thinks it sounds wacky, so please also send me an email, speak with me, because for a lot of the examples you've given, I can give you examples in other realms of halacha as well, meaning this idea that the importance of a person's masorah, the question of if I go somewhere and that's their masorah, or the question will be their minhag, could you be more machmir, can you be less machmir if you go somewhere else? These are questions that
right.
They come up all the time, but because our halachic life has, as you said, become sort of very standardized, institutionalized, so we've sort of lost these kind of very like human folds.
And I would say even more, it's become professionalized. So you have a rabbi that will come and deal with the burial, and you'll have another rabbi that will come to your house to set up the shiva, and you'll have another rabbi that will do A, B, C, and D. And as a result, we've lost our being in touch with the real world and halacha. I just want to end with one good story, okay? And this is a story. This explains what I would call a halachic vision, I don't mean vision like strategic vision. I'm talking about like halachic glasses. I once went for Pesach with my family to a place called Belmonte in Portugal. Belmonte was a community in the mountains of Portugal that had B'nai Anusim. And for 500 years, they lived as Christians, but everybody in the
Muranos,
time knew that they
right?
were
Muranos?
Jewish.
Muranos.
Yeah, Muranos. Yeah. Muranos is the, well, it's a, that's the actually probably the Spanish or Portuguese word, but Muranos is a negative
yeah,
term.
Yeah, yes, it's a
right?
negative
Murano
word.
Means
it's a judgmental
pigs.
Word.
So Anusim, yeah, Anusim is the word that's used today. It means, you know, those who were forced to pretend to be Christian. Anyway, in the 1980s, they sort of came out of the closet. Long story, the Rabbanut in Israel accepted them. They underwent a pro forma conversion. And they have 500 years of secrets, you know. If you can imagine, if you ever, I don't know how old you are, but if you met the Holocaust survivors that I saw when I was a kid, you know, they were always stressed. They would keep stash of cash in case the Nazis would come tomorrow.
Yeah,
they would have
my
money
grandmother,
to run,
my
know?
Grandmother.
Okay, there you go. So imagine though, 500 years of trauma and not one generation of trauma. So they had all sorts of secret prayers and customs and traditions. Anyway, I arrived to run their Seder and be with them for Pesach. It was an amazing opportunity. I lived with them, with my family. Anyway, I slaughtered 30 sheep the first day I was there, and the old men were taking the sheep, and they were skinning them and whatever. Anyway, they hung them up. You always hang an animal up by its back leg while you're skinning it and cleaning it. And I saw them make a cut into the side of the back leg, and I spoke a little bit of Spanish, and they didn't really speak English. I said, what are you doing? And they sort of said nothing. Anyway, I knew that it was something, because it wasn't a regular cut. It had nothing to do with taking the animal apart. And they wouldn't really speak to me about it. Anyway, I spent the whole week with them. And on Shabbat Chol HaMoed, finally they knew me. I was speaking to them in the shul. And I stopped speaking, and I said, I want to ask you a question. When I saw you guys doing what you did, you know, you made that cut. Was there meaning there? And I saw them shyly smiling to themselves. And yes, so this was their tradition on what the Gid Hanasha was, and that they would make this cut. And for 500 years, they were making this cut in remembrance of the prohibition of eating that sciatic nerve, the Gid Hanasha. And I often think about how a rabbi would arrive there and wouldn't have been sensitive to look for it, wouldn't have known, you know, that there might be some secret tradition that they have. And a scholar from the university would come and wouldn't have the halachic knowledge to even realize that something was going on. And having those eyeglasses, that halachic historic eyeglasses, gives you the ability to look at so much of what we do and so much of what we've lost and understand the importance of it. And like you said, it's fascinating, and it makes my life much, much richer, because it allows me to sometimes look at things a little bit differently and enjoy and understand things in a slightly different manner.
Dr. Art Greenspan, thank you for being on the podcast today. It was an absolute pleasure. It was fascinating. And
my pleasure.
I'd love to run into you on the streets of Efrat and hear some more stories.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.